Noah, thank you so much for joining me today. Super excited to chat with you. And Noah, okay, you've got a super interesting background. But before diving into that, I want to say like what you do. And you are a sales director at Fountain. Fountain is a high-end crypto art brokerage that connects buyers and sellers of high-end digital art and collectibles. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate. Yeah, we find buyers and sellers, and buyers and sellers come sometimes find us. We make the connection between the two.
Awesome. All right, so your background is super, super intriguing. Okay, so you were an intern at Gagosian, which I'd love to hear. For those who don't know, I would love to you explain that. You were at Christie's, you're at Yuga, you launched an NFT product called Howlers, and now you're at Fountain. So take me all the way back to your internship at Gagosian. Like, how'd you even first become involved in art or interested in art?
First of all, I was in college at NYU, and I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I think it's a very common thing when you're 18, 19 years old, you're kind of lost and ambient. But I was studying French absurdist theater. It was a really stupid thing to major in.
French absurdist theater. I've never even heard of that.
Yeah, like most people haven't. It's not a terribly useful focus of study outside of, we'll get into why it is actually useful in crypto maybe, but it's these highfalutin French thinkers, mostly French at least, or like expatriates who are living in France, who wrote these plays about sort of the craziness, the meaninglessness, the insanity of modern life. And some of the authors are Samuel Beckett, and you could even count somebody like Antonin Artaud, or I really, really like, see, I haven't thought about these guys in forever, but I really, really like Eugene Ionesco. He wrote probably my favorite absurdist plays. But in any case, I just had no idea what I wanted to do should be a creative industry. I wanted to be in some kind of creative. My dad was a songwriter. At the time, I was also making music, but I didn't want to just kind of rest on my dad's laurels, because he had a lot of success in his career as a songwriter. But that wasn't interesting to me to pursue songwriting and music as my kind of calling, just because, then you're on easy mode. And I could have done that, but I didn't, and decided I wanted to see if I could get an internship in the art world. And I had no idea what Gagosian was. I had no idea how the art world worked. Just was kind of a scrappy young dude looking for meaning and purpose. And I found art and stuck with it.
That's awesome. Okay, so how did you discover like Gagosian? To even apply, were you Googling like art internships, or how
I
did
mean,
that?
this is so yes, there was quite a lot of Googling art
Yeah.
internships and reaching out to people and family friends and friends of friends. And I threw a lot of darts at the board, and eventually friend of my mom's friend, lawyer, introduced me to somebody who worked at Gagosian, and they were like, "Hey, come and interview with us for an internship." And I Googled Gagosian because I didn't even know who Gagosian were. Turns out, they're the biggest art gallery on planet Earth, basically. And eventually wound up landing an internship in New York while I was at NYU for school. I was working in the publications department, which is, looking back on it, actually eerily similar to what specialists do at auction houses, what I would wind up doing after Gagosian. But we would put together catalogs for artists. So when artists would do a big exhibition with Gagosian, and they would be selling these multi-million dollar paintings and stuff, Gagosian had an in-house publications team that would create the text, the scholarly text that would be sold or offered alongside with the exhibition. So I would help to specifically, eventually my focus there was just on clearing copyright. So whenever there's an image used in these texts, these big tomes, sometimes they're massive, sometimes they're like much more, I don't know, bare bones. But I would have to go through and clear the copyright for any of the images that we didn't own. Funniest book that I worked on, often they were really funny and weird, maybe I just always look at things through that lens. But because I spoke a little bit of French, we were working on this book by Richard Prince about his book collection. And a lot of his book collection was like vintage French erotica. And we had to clear copyrights on these old, basically porno mags, you know, from the 40s and 50s. And I would have to call up these publishing houses, which had evolved since then into modern day pornographers. And I was on their website looking for their contact details. And like, I had felt so embarrassed at Gagosian in my suit, you know, sitting there browsing these extremely hardcore porn sites, just trying to find somebody who I can like call and beg to clear copyright for these images for Richard Prince. But so it was a lot of like loose odds and ends and things. I didn't learn much at all, really. So
that's hilarious. Okay. So that, yeah, that doesn't really sound very, I was expecting you to say like, oh, you know, I was, wheeling and dealing and I fell in love with the art world. And
no, not, it was way more like you get to peek behind the curtain into the sausage factory and see how the sausage gets made. And yeah, we get glimpses of deal making and the big sauntering, you know, guns of the art world, the hired guns, and then the shooters, the collectors and people who would stroll in. But really it was more like an osmosis kind of thing. If even that, cause I wasn't absorbing much. I was mostly just like, I can't believe how silly this whole industry really is.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So after that experience, what made you want to kind of double down and go to Christie's? Cause maybe you'd be like, oh, you know, I saw behind the curtain. I'm not super enthralled by this. Or maybe you were.
I don't know. I was amused by it. It was like, it was interesting, but Gagosian didn't offer me a job after interning with them for 4 years. So that's really the impetus for going to Christie's. I would have happily worked for Gagosian, even though I hated the person I was working for. And I wasn't really excited necessarily about the art world. I just wanted a job and to be able to continue living in New York and having fun and being a young idiot. But Christie's took me and that's where I really started to learn a trade, as it were, you know. I was a sales, not even an associate or anything. I was like basically an assistant to sales team. I was administering these auctions and they gave me really tough, kind of shitty auctions to manage at first, of course, entry-level idiot. But, you know, that was really tough and required a lot of focus and attention and definitely my skill set, my primary skill set is not in the attention to detail kind of category, but I was able to perform and I learned how to do these things. I became a post-sale manager and I had to be basically a combination of a therapist and an accountant.
Who?
The clients. Okay. Because, well, I'll explain. It's like the post-sale manager, if you're talking to a client, you're only talking to that client because something went terribly wrong or you're negotiating something, you know, like you get automatically CC'd on all the emails that are coming in for the sales that you manage. This is after the auction, right? So the auction's already done. Your job is to balance the books, make sure that you get paid when you're owed money on time. And if you don't, you got to keep the seller surprised. And if shipping goes wrong, let's say they put an elbow through the painting like Steve Wynn did, then you got to be the one to break the news and you got to figure out how to placate the angry client. Like it's never good if you're talking to somebody. But they gave me Asia Week to manage, and that was a probably the hardest thing I will ever do professionally, because man, that category, every different category at the auction house has their own kind of players and code and different sort of feel and vibes, like flavors of ice cream or something. But Asia Week, just to put it in perspective, I don't know if this is still true, but at the time that I was working in Sotheby's on Asia Week, the top auction houses in China that normally handle the stuff we were handling once a year, they would proudly advertise a default rate of 20% for their sales. That was considered good, you know.
That's when crazy.
It's just it's for some reason just a cultural difference there, and when we would host these sales, it was extremely important for us to kind of protect our clients who aren't used to that kind of culture. So we would have premium lots where you'd have to make a deposit before you're allowed to bid. And sometimes that deposit was very high in the six figures USD. And I would have to be the one to request it, keep track of it, keep an eye on who's bidding in the auctions and make sure they don't exceed their allowed balance amounts. And it was just a shit show, really. And again, it's all fascinating. It's all exciting. And there's a lot of adrenaline and a lot's on the line, but wasn't handling any art up close and personal. And that's all I wanted to do at that point. I was really, to be clear, like I haven't talked a lot about what drew me to art and why I wanted to be there. I've been mostly kind of silly and cynical. But I love contemporary art. Like I really, really love contemporary art. And that's where I wanted to be, was working in the contemporary art department, ideally as a cataloger specialist, and eventually met somebody again, you know, just by living life and going out and being engaging and open. And she worked at Christie's in the contemporary art department, needed a cataloger, asked me to apply. I did and got the job. And then, you know, that led eventually to being a specialist there in contemporary art and finally being in the right place at the right time for NFTs.
So you were at Sotheby's before. So is Gagosian, yes. Sotheby's, Christie's?
Gagosian, Sotheby's, and Christie's, yeah.
Okay. Take me back to your art your love of contemporary art. Like how did that even formulate? Because for me, I was intrigued by art through NFTs. Like I knew nothing about art before that, right? So what was your initial love and how did you learn about it?
Well, so the most formative memory I have, well, there's two really, really strong memories, art experiences as a child. First of all, I'll also say my grandma on my mom's side was a painter. My aunt on my mom's side, also a painter, and she's a really successful and talented oil painter too. So painting has always been sort of my great love. Like I just love paintings. But that being said, my first strongest memory of art is a Picasso sculpture. I went to the Picasso retrospective in LA when I was like 8 or 9 years old or something. And I remember really vividly towards the end of the exhibition, they had this bronze baboon with young, I think is the name of the piece. It's a baboon mother, like a monkey mom with her baby in her arms. But Picasso cast the bronze out of found objects, and
cool.
The face of the baboon mother is made out of this toy car that he tore in half and then put the halves on top of each other to make a baboon face. And I just remember sitting there, and I was standing in an art exhibition, looking at this thing on the podium, and it's way taller than me. And I'm staring up at it and I'm thinking, how did he get from toy car to this bronze? And then the idea of breaking the toy in half, casting it, and then it's found its way to this setting where I'm looking at it. All that was like really, really exciting and fascinating to me. And my mom bought me a sketchbook on the way out. And from that point on, I was just like drawing, always drawing. So that's where it started, was just drawing. And then the other big, bright, shiny memory is going to the Centre Pompidou when I was a teenager. So walking through the Centre Pompidou when I was like 13 or 15 and just being totally astonished by how stupid most of the art seemed, you know, it was just silly as fuck, man. Cause this was my first time being exposed to like really avant-garde art, which I came to love eventually. But this was also the third museum we'd visited that day. We really packed our agenda. So we went to the Musée d'Orsay and then the Louvre and then the Centre Pompidou. So we were really, really, really tired. But my brother and my dad and I, we were just walking through the Pompidou, taking pictures of us making fun of paintings, basically. You know, paintings that eventually I'd learned to love. But there's one moment, especially, I was standing underneath a snow shovel hung from the ceiling and the shadows are all over the ground. And we're pointing up at the snow shovel like, look at this stupid fuck. That is a Marcel Duchamp sculpture. It's a very famous sculpture. I think it's called Memory of the Broken Arm. I could be wrong. But yeah, we were totally mocking everything.
It's funny that I'm seeing this connection from French absurdist theater to, you know, kind of this love of contemporary art and kind of the absurdity of contemporary art. and then developing a passion for it, which is so cool.
I would agree. Yeah, I think that's true. I think you're right on. That's basically my mindset. Is like you go from edgy teenage idiot where nothing matters to, oh, nothing matters. Everything matters.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
If nothing matters, then everything matters, and everything's beautiful. Like right. you don't have to worry about these distinctions anymore at a certain point. So that's kind of the beauty of absurdism. It's like, oh, someone can look at it and say, this is nonsense, this is garbage. And you're like, it's also brilliant, you know?
Totally.
That's awesome. It's one and the same thing. There's no distinction. So
love that. Okay. So after leaving Sotheby's, that was post-sale manager. You want to get closer to the action. Christie's was in the sales. And so tell me about like, what is the sales department at Christie's? Like, what does that even mean?
So I was in the contemporary art department then, and my job was to catalog artworks for sale. So when a collector approaches the auction house, they get an estimated value. They get an estimate range. Usually it's a low estimate, high estimate. They cut a deal and they get under contract. They ship the art to the auction house, and then it needs to be prepared for sale. Somebody's got to photograph it. You've got to write the condition report for it. You've got to take the dimensions down. You got to do the research. You got to all of these things. And all those things came down to me. It was my responsibility for my sales to literally go down in the basement at Christie's and measure everything, write the condition reports. And these would be sales with hundreds of lots in them. And you would get a couple months to do it. And that was where everything like it got really serious. I was staying until like 2 a.m. sometimes, cataloging these things and learning so much and being able to actually touch the art, you know. It was amazing. It was super cool. I was terrified most of the time. And that was my first exposure to real, real intense stress. It wasn't as bad as Asia Week. Like Asia Week was everything kind of like really focused into one tiny hard to swallow pill, but Christie's like, I don't know, man. I was so burnt out after my first real sales season. Did it for two, three, four seasons, something, and then eventually got the nod to be a junior specialist and start running my own auctions. And so did that for a while and did a little private sales stuff. Started developing my own contacts, my own clients, just by walking up to people in the sale room, you know, and people who are looking at paintings and saying, hey, you like that? You know, like, let's talk about it. And going out on appraisals and seeing art in collectors' homes, being able to meet them there, just sort of slowly but surely you pick these people up and you get close to them and you're able to put together your own auctions. And that's what I was doing. I was the head of online sales when the pandemic happened, and you know, then everything changed again. And when NFTs became a thing, and when digital art became exciting to everybody who's locked up at home, cooped up and bored during the pandemic, they also just recently got their stimulus checks and they're fucking around in the internet. Everyone started coming to me asking me about NFTs because I'm the online sales specialist at Christie's. And that's sort of how we arrived at that moment of the Beeple sale. It's just from that point on, I mean, it's already been a rocky road or adrenaline filled rush. But from that point on, it was actually totally a blur. It's still a blur.
So freaking cool. And by the way, you're an incredible storyteller. I'm like so enthralled right now, but okay. So the cataloging, I know this is like really dumb of me to ask, but like you're saying, oh, I was at Christie's and I was cataloging like art. Does that really mean like, hey, this piece is from this artist and, you know, we're writing it down in our book and now I'm going to go to this piece and write, it's just like accounting for the art?
I mean, look, I would go down with a notebook like this. Mm. I'd be at my desk up at Christie's. I'd take the elevator down to the basement where they keep all the art. The art handler would pull things out for me that were in my sale. And I would have a measuring tape, sometimes a flashlight, a UV light to look at the painting under black light. And I would just start taking notes, you know, take the measurements, take pictures of the front and the back. Your phone is like your best friend. You know, you're literally like all of the pictures that go into the folder where you can reference the condition of the painting, they happen on your phone. So yeah, that was the process, basically. Go downstairs, spend a couple hours pulling out art, writing these things up, and then go upstairs and finish your research. Then you got to crack the books. Then you got to figure out what books it's been illustrated in, if any, what exhibitions it's been a part of. You have to authenticate it. And all of these things, every artist has a different process. And some of them have no process. Like that's when shit got, I keep on saying that's when this went. It's always been fascinating. That's why I'm having fun and that's why I'm here. But one interesting facet of art at auction and artists is authentication and artists' estates and things like that. This is also interesting for NFTs. It's like NFTs can play a big role here. But for example, I'll take two different contemporary artists and you can see how different they are and how they approach authentication. Calder Foundation. Alexander Calder, surrealist, sculptor. He made the mobiles, the whimsical mobiles with the crazy biomorphic shapes. They're painted red, blue, yellow, black, sometimes white. And the way it works for his art, including works on paper and sculpture, really anything, you have to send it in person for a review at the Calder Foundation. I think they're still based in New York. They should be. And they go through meticulously one by one and they do the cataloging for you effectively. Everything gets what's called an A number. If you don't have an A number in the catalog at auction, you shouldn't be selling it. It really shouldn't be offered for sale. And the Calder Foundation, they're very like focused on what's coming to auction, obviously, because they're reviewing it all. If you put something in your sale without an A number, you're gonna lose your job. So they're super, super buttoned up, and they're also active in the artist market too. You know, they play a role in the marketplace. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have somebody like Franz Klein. So Franz Klein is an abstract expressionist painter. He made a lot of works on newsprint, and he didn't have any kind of robust cataloging system as he was making these artworks. He was really just like trading them out to friends. This was like the beginning of abstract expressionism in New York. And a lot of these guys and women too were heavy drinkers, heavy partiers, and they were sort of making art to make ends meet. And they would just sell these things to friends and give them away. And so there's all sorts of ephemera out there. Franz Klein was making works on newspaper and telephone book pages and things like that as sketches for his paintings. There's no authentication process whatsoever. There's no catalog resume. There's no estate. There's nobody you can contact. So we would get these Franz Klein works all the time and they would look right. You know, it's black ink on a really old telephone book page. And we would be told that this is the provenance. It comes down to like a judgment call. Like, do you trust this person? You know, are you going to put this in your sale? Are you going to agree that this is what it is? Because the auction house has a level of authority too. You're like an arbiter in a way. And you know, I don't think I handled any fakes, but I don't know when it comes to Franz Klein. With Calder, I can say like, you know, Calder Foundation, they gave it an A number. Franz Klein works on paper. I'm like, looked right, felt right. But we would turn around, we would mostly turn these things away if it wasn't ironclad. So there was a kind of standard that we had to follow.
So, you know, yeah, I mean, getting to the topic of NFTs, which I don't want to dig too deep into right now, but instantly solves one of the biggest issues. Or would you say it's one of the biggest issues or the biggest issue around art?
There you go. Exactly right. I wouldn't say it's the biggest issue. It's a massive one, though. And NFTs, if you're able, think about my role as I just described it, beyond just authenticating the artwork. What if there was a blockchain that contained all of the cataloging information already? What if when the Calder got to Christie's, you didn't have to send it to the Calder Foundation because you could just check the chain and see, oh, damn, that's this one, you know? Mm-hmm. And it is exactly the size. It's been in all these exhibitions. It's been illustrated in these books. It used to belong to this person. It would make the industry so much more efficient and organized and trustworthy too, which is funny because it's a trustless system, blockchain. But I would have told you that's what NFTs are going to be used for. You know, when I first learned about NFTs was in 2018. Christie's did a sale with Barney Ebsworth's collection. So Ebsworth collection, a really amazing American art collection. And as part of the promotion for that sale, I don't know, I think one of the family members or somebody attached to the consignment, they worked in NFTs and blockchain tech. And we offered NFTs alongside all of the pieces in the collection that contained all the provenance. So that there was an organization, I think they're called Artory, and I don't know if they're still around, A-R-T-O-R-Y. And I could be getting some of this wrong, but I'm pretty sure we were selling NFTs as not selling them per se, but including them alongside the works of art in this collection. And that's what I thought this stuff would be used for. It's like a great database for collecting information. Lo and behold, of course, the most absurd outcome is that the NFTs would become the art itself. And that's what wound up happening. So good luck trying to predict the future.
All right. So I want to go to back when we were at Christie's, junior sales specialist, I believe is what you said. You said you were putting together your own auctions and meeting your own clients. Like what do you mean by that?
Oh man. Well, you're just kind of like fighting tooth and nail to get property together and make a coherent sale. You know, when you are the head of a sale, you got to make the estimates for everything you're selling, basically. A lot of the work actually happens in other specialists' offices. You know, everyone sources for each other's sales. But you're the one who gets to decide where each lot goes, how much room they get on the page in the catalog that you print, what kind of scholarly due diligence you're going to do. If you're going to write an essay, for example, there are some like in-house writers at Christie's who you can use sparingly. Or a lot of times the catalog essays get written by interns, especially in the lower value sales. Yeah, you're sort of just surviving. When you're young and junior and green, when people give you an opportunity, when they say, hey, I want you to go out to the Hamptons and do this appraisal for this client, you basically have to go to their house and catalog all of the paintings as they're on the wall, you know? Because that's, keep in mind, Christie's auctions are just one part of the business. There's also appraisals, there's client services, there's the shipping, there's the people who install the art, who are like really the fucking unsung heroes, the people who are moving this art around the building. It's amazing how they can do their job, even, you know, at the pace we need to move. But so you kind of just grab who you can stick to, you know, or who sticks to you, and see what you can get done. You cut deals, you know, you make shit happen.
And then when you got moved to the, or did you want to go to the online sales, or was that kind of, were you intrigued by that? Or are you like, eh, you know, this is kind of...
No, it was the next step up. It was, you know, for me, it was like, would I have wanted to be the head of the day sale? Yeah, eventually, sure. But the day, being the head of the day sale, you're the head of a 20, 30 million, $50 million total sale, whatever. I was way more comfortable in the online sales space, because when I took over the online auctions, I mean, not to sound like an asshole, but it was a little bit like the garage sale version of contemporary art at Christie's, like the bargain bin. And you would be selling stuff that had already been offered before and didn't sell its first time around, or maybe it's like the third time it's being reoffered and you keep chopping the estimate down. You'd be dealing with these minor artists very frequently in like in huge volume who don't show up in the evening sale. And you're like, God, I have to look at another one of these Norman Blum paintings. And that means nothing to you, but like, man, I had to look at so many fucking Norman Blum paintings. But yeah, it was what was available for me as the kind of hierarchy is shifting around. What I was ultimately really interested in still was just getting to be up close and personal with art that I love. And sometimes there was art that I love in my sales. More often it was art in the evening sales, but I got to be close to all of it. So it was just sort of, yeah, an adventure from A to Z.
Take me through the process of the Beeple sale. Cause I mean, that's still to this day is completely insane. Take me through, you know, that whole, cause you said you went from like a sleepy backwater to now suddenly it's like, this is like the hub of everything.
Yeah. so when the pandemic hit, you know, we had to pivot instantly to a completely remote business. We weren't going to just shut down operations. We still ran auctions. We ran day sales, and we even had this really super highly produced evening sale during lockdown. So my expertise, if you can call it that, as the head of online sales guy, was suddenly very in demand. You know, everybody needed to figure out how to run online sales. So I was helping out with the day sale team, the evening sale team. We're trying to just make it work, right? And have a successful season during this, like, I was going to say pandemonium, and that's funny how pandemonium sounds just like pandemic. Anyway, towards the end of the meltdown, the lockdown, in 2021, when I started hearing about NFTs, and the day that the Beeple opportunity came to us, was literally the day of, the Capitol insurrection, January 6th. So I just remember it super vividly. You know, I was one of the only people in the office. It was me and another, more junior specialist. At that time, I was already just a regular specialist, but, my colleague, Megan Doyle, who was a junior specialist at the time, shouted over to me. I was over a bookshelf laying out my sale. "Hey, would you put an NFT in your sale?" And I was like, "Sure. I don't know. What is an NFT really? You know, what do you mean NFTs?" I remember those from 2018, you know, when we did the Ebsworth collection. And she was like, "Well, they're really blowing up right now." And she was showing me all the sale results. And just recently, Beeple had his... really successful debut at
Nifty Gateway.
Yeah, Nifty Gateway. Yep. And I saw these numbers. And I'm like, millions of dollars for this stuff? Okay, yeah, sure. Let's put it in my auction. Let's just see what happens. And that was it, basically. You know,
wow.
I got introduced to Mike. We hit it off. I really love Mike. I still to this day like consider Mike like, I don't know. We're forged in fire friends, sort of, from going through this shit together. But we had a couple Zooms and we had some conversations over email, and we sort of, you know, his first submission, I've told this story a bazillion times, but he wanted to sell as the NFT his 5,000th every day. So just one every day. It wasn't the collage. And the 5,000th every day, it may even still be pinned on his Twitter page, but it was like atrocious. It was like maximum Beeple energy. It's a self-portrait of him as a kid doodling, and behind him he's got Buzz Lightyear with tits and Kim Jong-un and a Pikachu erections. I don't know. It was not acceptable for a Christie's auction. So I wrote back to him like, "Dude, we can't do this. We can't. I love you, man, but I don't know. This is not going to work." And we did a little brainstorming and came up with the 5,000 every days as a collage, like using his Instagram as a found object artwork, kind of like just taking it wholesale, making it one thing that felt cool and interesting and acceptable. Of course, after the sale, the traditional art world, when they were all up in arms and angry about it, they found a way to make that problematic too, because they went through and picked out all of Mike's early offensive work, and it became this like super hot button issue. I had to defend it in front of the ED&I committee and all this shit. It was like, I mean, to be totally honest, there's some problematic stuff in there, but like, it was insane. It was insane. I thought on a good day, if it made $1 million, I asked, Ryoma Ito at, Maker's Place, who's one of our collaborators on the sale. Which I should also say, like, without Maker's Place and Ryoma specifically, this auction would have never happened. So, but I was asking Ryoma, what's this going to sell for? You know, there's all this chatter and excitement, and I don't know what I'm doing. And he was like, at least $1 million. I'm like, okay, great. $1 million's great. And then within 8 minutes of opening the auction for sale, we got to $1 million bid. And
wow.
It would have kept going. It would have kept going because, that's where we set our credit limit. After $1 million, you needed to KYC. So that was a hard stop. So we opened the lot for bidding, instantly shoots up to $1 million and then stops there. And that was like, oh fuck.
Whoa.
You know, this is so much bigger than anybody anticipated. And what a lot of people forget or don't realize is that that sale went on for 2 weeks. That's a traditional auction at Christie's, the online sales, that they, because you're dealing with like the gerontocracy of art collecting. They need a long time to get ready and like get their shit together and bid on this stuff. They want to come to the exhibition. They want to like plan to come into town. So it took a long time to get from a million to 69 million. But those 2 weeks are, I can't tell you about any of the days in between. From the day that the bidding started to the moment the sale ended, I don't have any recollection whatsoever of what it felt like, what happened, who I talked to. It's just gone. But yeah, when it finally ended and it was $69 million, it was just like, okay, this now my life, I'm going to just focus on NFTs. Like I'm goodbye contemporary world. Yeah. This is what I'm doing now. Cause that's just to put it into context and like get down to the exact numbers here. There were almost 50 bidders in the sale. I think it was 48. Only three of them were previously clients of Christie's. So everybody else is brand new. The average age of those bidders, cause we had to KYC everybody. This is above a million, by the way, 50 above a million. We had to KYC everybody. And the average age was like 2 decades younger than our average contemporary art collector. Contemporary art, not average Christie's client, but contemporary art collector. So those kind of numbers, I mean, they're just completely unheard of. It was the first time you'd ever seen this kind of frenzy of bidding. So there was also a lot of excitement from the top down, you know, from the people who I report to and who they report to and who they report to is all like, okay, you need to keep this up. So yeah, then it was all about what's the next thing. And I've said this before and I'll say it again, and I should get it like tattooed on myself somewhere, but you're only as good as your last sale. That's the saying in the auction world. So I took that to heart and tried to just keep going. And we can't talk about every sale we did during that run at Christie's. We don't have time, but all said and done, it was $150 million worth of NFTs when I left. So 69 was in the first people, 27, I think, was in Human One. So still, I mean, like 60 million more or less in not people NFTs. Wow. Crazy run.
That's amazing. I need to write a book about this whole process or this whole, you know, journey, because that's incredible.
When it's over. I mean, we still got to, I think that, you know, what's happening right now, when we're seeing the market kind of get excited again and things starting to get silly again, that could have been just the beginning. There was a time where a lot of people had doubts, and of course, myself included, like I'm full of doubt at all times. But there was a time during the bear market that followed that bull market, I think, where all of us probably were like, is this really gonna come back? Is this actually the paradigm shifting new dimension of contemporary art? Or was this kind of like a flash in the pan and Beanie Babies tulip kind of thing? I think those are kind of hackneyed, stupid comparisons ultimately, but you know, they are the comparisons that get thrown around. So, but here we are.
To touch on that, you know, when I first got involved in Bitcoin 2013, 2014, when the crash happened, I was like, oh, it's over. Like Bitcoin's done, it's over, you know, it's all gone. And I was like a big blockchain believer and not a Bitcoin believer. I was like, blockchain makes total sense. Bitcoin's trash. Like, you know, whatever. It wasn't until 2016. I got back in. I was like, you know what? Like non-sovereign money makes a lot of sense. Like, I think it's going to be, you know, stay here. 2017, you know, that crazy market, a lot of my friends that were normies, like they got involved. Mm-hmm. And then when it crashed in 2018, they were like, dude, like it's all over. It's all. And I was like, no. Like that's exactly what I thought last cycle, you know?
Yeah. Right.
And then, you know, this most recent bear market, there's no question from anyone that I know. Well, that's not true. Any of my people in the space that like, is this going to go away? It was just that there was no question.
You were like convinced. You never had a moment during this bear market where you
thought. In 2018, I was like, this is here to stay. I was like, I've already been through this.
Wow.
2018, this is here to stay. So I've been fully, you know, fully involved since then. And this bear market is just like, okay, like, you know, we're going to have to just stick through it. But everything else is fine. We had a lot of investors and friends and family, especially saying, hey, you know, I read this article on Bloomberg, NFTs are down 99.99%. Like my own mother, she texted me in November. It was November. Yeah. It was like very recently. It was like, hey, now that NFTs are dead, like, what are you focused on? You know, like, what are you doing? I was like, what are you talking about? So no, it's pretty incredible. Like, yeah, with me that there's no, I think NFT art, and this is, we're kind of getting up, you know, going on a tangent here. NFT art is going to far surpass physical art sales within 10 years, like far surpass. Maybe 10 years is a little bit too early, but 20 years for sure.
Look, so. I don't think anything's crazy at this point. I think anything's possible. Yeah, sure. Yeah, that. But I mean, even more practically, more like in the real world, as a data point, Fountain, where I'm at now, we just sold a set of autoglyphs just a week ago for 5,000 Ethereum, which at the time was like $15 million. It's more than that today, even.
Right.
That was just last week. That's a top five sale for me. You know, I've, if I'm putting it into context in terms of my career so far, which is just 2 years, really 3 years. You've got the Beeple, 69 million. You've got Human One at 27, 28. You have Matt and John's CryptoPunks at 17 million. And then you have Matt and John's Autoglyphs, which sold last week for 15. So, you know, that's huge. That's huge. Awesome.
All right. So after Christie's, you went over to Yuga to steward, I think it was CryptoPunks and Meebits.
No, I didn't have anything to do with Meebits. So okay. totally different vertical. I was only focused on CryptoPunks. That was a complete surprise. You know, I was invited to go over there, or at least to try out, basically have an introductory conversation via Guy Osiri, who I'd connected with during the bull market. I think we worked directly on the World of Women sale. We put a World of Women NFT in a London evening sale that did well. And so he kind of called me out of the blue saying, well, what if I had an opportunity for you that could be interesting? And would you take it? And I said, yeah, I'm interested to have a conversation. And that wound up being CryptoPunks. And I was shocked and excited. I remember coming out of the Zoom, I had it in that room behind me, you know, when they made the offer formally. And I just sat down literally on that wooden pole there and like just thought, you know, how crazy this is that now I'm going to steward this brand that I love so much and was totally unknown to me before crypto happened. You know, I didn't own, to be clear, I've also spoken about this on other podcasts too, but like when that Beeple sale happened, I didn't own a laptop computer at home. I didn't own any crypto. I was like a Luddite by choice. I wasn't on any social media. I'm still skeeved out by most social media. I hate it, but I also love it too. You know, I have like some really tight knit Discord communities that I'm in, Telegram groups, things like that. People I know really well, better than my closest friends who are anonymous online cartoon animal people. but you know, it was all just kind of surreal and still is surreal. And I'm glad that I got the chance to work on CryptoPunks.
That's awesome. Okay. So after CryptoPunks, you thought, okay, what was the thought process of leaving Yuga and leaving CryptoPunks? Was it, hey, there's a really cool opportunity to kind of launch this native, brokerage that doesn't exist yet? Or what was the,
to be totally clear, that decision was the first time where I like had to step away from my own self for my own selfish reasons. And actually, it's not really, I guess you could call it a selfish reason, but I had a son. I have a son now. And
congrats.
Thank you. Yeah. My wife and I decided together that it didn't make sense for me to be so focused and unavailable and not present during the beginning of my son's life. And we're really fortunate enough that we can take a pause, right? So decided to step away. You know, I felt like it was the right thing to do for my family. And, you know, for 2 years, basically, I wasn't really making choices for my family. I was making choices that were good for my career and for the space. And at least I thought, you know, I made a lot of mistakes, to be totally clear. Like there are definitely plenty of things I regret. But that was the first major decision where it was like, okay, family's coming first. I didn't know Fountain existed. You know, I found Fountain on Twitter. You know, I saw Fountain tweet, we're the new crypto native brokerage, and clicked into their page and they had like 1,000 followers or something. And I'm like, this is built for me. This is what I want to do. This is where I want to be. and reached out to my friends at Flamingo DAO because I saw in their bio that Fountain were incubated by Flamingo DAO, and got to meet the people who run the show at Fountain, and eventually joined up, and now we're just, I don't know, we're doing really well. We're kicking ass and taking names. We're connecting buyers and sellers and trying to cut deals at the best prices possible as often as we possibly can. And we're growing really fast, and it's exciting stuff. It feels just as turbulent and promising as it ever has for me in this space.
That's incredible. Okay, so why does Fountain need to exist? Couldn't you know, Christie's and Sotheby's continue to do what they do and kind of use them, or like, well, yeah, tell me about Fountain.
Well, what I think separates us is we're a much slimmer team, right? So we're very focused and in sync with each other. It's like five of us, really, less than five of us. But we're able to get shit done quickly and efficiently, and in a more crypto native way too. We're comfortable using the blockchain for what it was built for, you know. We escrow the NFTs that we sell. An interesting thing about the sale process at the auction houses, at least when I worked there, we didn't take possession of any of the NFTs that we sold. So the legal department said you can't. You know, there was so much about the sale process for NFTs at Christie's that was just no. It was somebody saying, no, you can't do this for XYZ reason. It was usually the legal department. I love the legal department there, and I respect them a lot. But it was very often like, yeah, you're not going to be able to do that. So being able to take possession of the NFTs is one thing, but speaking the language fluently. And then finally, our commission is a lot more generous, if you will. It's a lot more realistic, I think. Auction houses take 25%. Basically, Sotheby's just adjusted their buyer's premium. Excuse me. So I think it might be a little bit less now. But they also take a commission from the seller. And even so, with this gigantic slice of the profits going to the auction house, like 35% of the sale proceeds, auction houses' margins are so thin. It's like, yeah, I think this is public knowledge too, because at least Sotheby's is a public company, but in a good year, an auction house can make like $50 million in profit.
Shocking.
Yeah. Just like it's like a well-placed urban Whole Foods, you know, like yeah. Union Square Whole Foods, a couple of Whole Foods stores. But so we're able to charge a much more generous commission because we're not shipping and handling things. We're not employing hundreds of people. We're not a global business. We're an internet-based business. We're a work-from-home team. You know, there's no rent or whatever. We charge 5%. It's just a flat commission above $1 million, and we just adjusted now because we're getting a lot of traction and doing a lot of deals. It's 6% below $1 million from here on out. But so that's a fraction, obviously, of what the auction house is charged, so that we can compete with them in that sense. But ultimately, the real what it really boils down to, why we need to exist, it's like, yeah, okay, the blockchain is great for as a permissionless system, no middlemen. I understand that mentality. But if you have $1 million JPEG, or God forbid, 10 JPEGs that wind up being worth $15 million together, good luck just selling that on your own. Like, often people need help. It's not just that they want it. Yeah, they want it, but they also need it to get the best price. And when you don't have somebody advocating for you, because we do that, we advocate for our sellers, and we fight for them to get the best price, then it's really easy to get screwed. So, and similarly, we want to help buyers find what they're looking for. Very often what we're selling at Fountain is not something that's listed on OpenSea or Blur or any of the other marketplaces, Magic Eden or whatever, CryptoPunk's marketplace app. So we can do things discreetly and kind of more surgically for clients. And there are certain collectors who have a lot of work, you know, or their wallets are very public and known, where if they list something, then it can become a catastrophe for the broader ecosystem. You know, if they want to sell, nobody wants to do this, by the way, and this is not a specific example, but if you want to sell like 50 CryptoPunks in one clip and you just list them all in the open market, you're going to get crucified. So we can help somebody DCA out of their collection, or TWAP out of their collection, if you want to use those acronyms. I literally don't even basically know what those mean. Those are new to me. But I figure that's what we're doing, basically. We just want everybody to be happy at the end of it.
That's awesome. Okay, so how are the collectors different? Because you have vast experience in traditional art world and crypto art world. Are these the same types of folks? Are they radically different? Tell me about the collectors.
It varies case by case. And in some cases, they're one and the same. You know, there is a Venn diagram here. There are people from the contemporary art world who were my clients before all of this happened, who transact in a meaningful way in the NFT space and collect in the NFT space. The vast majority of NFT collectors don't come from the traditional art world, obviously. They're younger, they skew a lot more male, they look like you and I, which is, you know, that's something that probably will change. I hope does change, that we get more diversity in this space. But I think it is, the mentality of collectors is different too. The time horizon, the outlook is way more short-term focused. In the art world, it's gauche to sell a painting within like 2 or 3 years even of buying it. I mean,
oh wow.
There are like certain instances where it would be acceptable, but if it's, especially if it's contemporary art, if it's brand new and you're flipping it at auction, you're going to get blacklisted by every gallerist who shows that artist's work, because you've shown now that you're not going to protect them. And also, when you put the art at auction, you're taking all the profits for yourself. There's no such thing as creator royalties at an auction house. Mm. There's no such thing as like residuals for the gallerist or the person who handles the artist's studio and represents them. So there's this kind of like tension there that doesn't exist in the NFT space, or it's nascent in the NFT space, because I'm starting to see this develop. You know, just it's really, really fascinating to see. But there are ways in which the NFT space, and I know your question was about collectors, but it's just making me think about how slowly but surely, actually pretty quickly, considering we've only been here for 2 years, the NFT space is starting to look a lot more like the contemporary art world.
So in which ways is that? Because I still feel like people are wheeling and dealing and trying to make moves. There are definitely people that love it for the art, but I feel like that in the regular art world, people love it for the art. People are not necessarily trying to purely make that.
Yes and no. I mean, there are definitely some contemporary art collectors who are there to flip and make money. You know, there's somebody who kind of embodied that for a while was Stefan Simkovitz. So, Simco, as he's referred to often, he was associated with this specific movement, I guess you could call it. It's more like a trend or a fad in the contemporary art world called zombie formalism. A bunch of young artists who are our age still, but who at the time were like in their 20s. And their stuff was selling for like millions of dollars at auction after they sold it for tens of thousands, if that. And Stefan, what he would do was go, and this is common knowledge, not disclosing anything that isn't already out there in the media. You can Google this, but he would buy out artists' entire studios. You know, he would kind of ordain them. He'd say like, you know, these are unknown kind of young, naive, impressionable artists. And he's like, you're amazing. I want to make you famous. Like, give me everything. And then he would flip them for enormous gains. And sometimes the artists wouldn't get much at all from those gains, and Stefan would move on to something new. So that flipping dynamic is definitely more prevalent in NFTs, but it's not exclusive to NFTs.
And so are you seeing collectors, I don't know, take a more longer term mindset within the NFT ecosystem, or how is it
evolving? I think it's too soon to say. Certainly more collectors are thinking about what this stuff could be worth in 10 years, you know, but there's not a lot of people who are thinking about like, what's this going to be worth for my kids? You know, I think when we really start to see that change, it's going to be a generational shift. Assuming these things hold their value that long, right? which you and I probably, we would say, yeah, they're going to. I think someone was saying that I undersold, or we found, we undersold the autoglyphs at 15 million, saying like, oh, those autoglyphs are going to be worth 100 million in 10, 20, 30 years, whatever, however many years it's going to be. And my response was like, maybe, yeah, maybe so. But if that's the case, in all likelihood, the road to that price is going to be paved with sales like this one, 15 million, then 20 million, then 30. It's not going to be like no sales and then 50 years from now, the $100 million sale. That happened with Beeple, but that was an extraordinary circumstance. So it's magical thinking. I think it's going to take us a long time to grow up. We're still very much in our awkward, nascent teenage years, you know, like acne scars are not even there yet. We have acne right now.
I mean, it's crazy to think that the NFT ecosystem, as 99.99% of the populace knows about it, you know, started in 2021, like, you know, 3 years ago, right? So it's like, it is a brand new market. It's very rare that brand new markets appear. And this is a brand new market. And what's cool about NFTs is that they're made up of so many different sub-markets, which are changing, you know, video games, or changing collectibles, or changing art. They're changing all these different subsectors.
Yeah.
And I think art is just so exciting for so many reasons. One thing that I'm always going back to in art is, why is it an appealing asset class? Like, why are people willing to spend millions and millions of dollars on art in TradFi, like traditional art? Mm-hmm. And then why is it the same thing in digital art? Or like, how is digital art different than like traditional art?
That's a great question. You know, art is one of those timeless things that's been around since before we really even were human, I guess. You know, I'm thinking of hands on the cave walls. Yeah, exactly. Cave paintings and ancient art. Human beings have always wanted to leave a trace behind and to kind of interact with the world in a way that's going to express how they feel and endure once they're gone. Not every work of art is meant to last forever, of course. But there's something about that need to express yourself. And I think people started to collect those expressions once it became clear how emotionally valuable they were. Like, they were emotionally significant, and beautiful, just beautiful to look at, before they were worth a lot of money. You know, I think the beauty and the culture and the desire to catalog your moment in time and in history, that comes before the monetary value is attached to it. So probably the reason why we still do it to this day, it has to do a little bit with that, with those ideas like, oh, I want to own the culturally significant items from XYZ period. I want to own the beautiful things that make me feel alive, you know, and experience life to the fullest. But there's also these other concerns now, like prestige and competition and generational wealth, trying to secure generational wealth through paintings. And, you know, it's fascinating. There's various reasons why people collect. But in NFTs, you're seeing a lot of the same reasons too. You know, I know plenty of people who buy NFTs not just because they want to flip it for short-term profits, but because they think the art is important. People get so lost in the valuations for this stuff and the bottom line and the money. And yeah, that's great. I'm very happy that people are making money and artists are thriving. Very many artists are thriving in this space. You know, you can't forget, like, for every flipper that gets rich, like, there was an artist behind that. There's somebody who is benefiting, at least, you know, in some kind of way from these high value secondary sales, that there is likely to be another one, right? You know, of course markets can overheat and then there's a correction. But again, we're still just 2 years into this. So there's going to be a lot of comeback stories, I think, too, for artists who maybe haven't had big sales for a while. I think it's all really exciting and nascent and developing, you know.
That's awesome. Okay, so one thought I had around art and NFT art specifically is that art is one of the most effective means to display status because it's such a condensed, it's just like, hey, I'm going to spend so much money on this thing that actually has zero utility. And I can do that because I'm so wealthy and so powerful and have a lot of resources, whatever. And, you know, it's an innate part of humans to want to display status because it, you know, does a lot of things. And like when you digitize that behavior, you just turn it up to level 11. And I think NFTs are like the you know, it's now faster, it's easier to transact, it's more liquid, it's more, it's like a meme, a monetizable meme where you can show it on the internet.
Yes, that's true. But I think you can take it a step further too. It's also easy to do it yourself. And you don't have to, I think the big barrier to entry for a young person, for example, to collecting contemporary art is like, they don't want to walk into the gallery and like prove themselves to this old person. And their first experience with art, for the most part, like young wealthy people, young affluent people, people who grow up in kind of like generational wealth type situations, like families that have incredible fortunes that include art collections, their first experience with owning art is not going to be buying it because they want to own it for themselves. It's going to be inheriting it when their relatives die. And it's going to be stressful. It's going to be annoying. It's going to be scary. They're going to have to deal with taxes. They're going to probably have to take a bunch of stuff to auction and go through this bewildering, lengthy process. Maybe, you know, their painting gets damaged or something and they have to deal with that. Or the painting doesn't sell, or it sells for way less than they expected. So I tend to think that young people who wind up in this situation and have to go through it, they're going to have a negative association with owning art. It's like, okay, never again, not doing that, not doing that again. It's not always going to be the case, but I think it's having seen how this plays out and how intense it is, I don't know. I mean, I'm just trying to put myself into that position. I don't want to inherit a Picasso. I don't want to give my kids a Picasso. I don't want them to have to deal with that. I'd be scared to own a Picasso, but am I afraid to own a CryptoPunk? Not at all. I'm very happy. I don't own a lot of things. The stuff that you see in the background, like the painting on the wall I made, it's just like blue, dark blue paint on a canvas. I only collect digital art. You know, I only collect NFTs, really. NFTs and tattoos. There's a weird, funny link between, I think, tattoos and NFTs, but
explain that. I want to hear that.
Okay. So, NFTs, are a little like tattoos in that when I get a tattoo, it's art that exists in my body in my skin, belongs to me and only me, but it's also like available to everyone. Everyone can see it. If you're around me, that's cool. You can see my tattoos. But they're soul bound tokens, right? Like I can't sell you my tattoos. Sorry. You can't take this out of my skin. Maybe after I die, you can skin me and like take it and then you own it. But NFTs are like, tattoos are like soul bound non-fungible token. Yeah. Somebody else might have a different, like the same tattoo that I have. This is a very famous Ed Hardy, design. A lot of people have this tattoo, but this one is mine. You know, it's only in my skin. This is my non-fungible Ed Hardy eagle tattoo. And I think that idea of something that you own that is yours, but in a weird kind of ephemeral way, that's what allowed me at least to conceptualize NFTs and like be attracted to NFTs. I'm like, oh, this is cool. In the same way that I think collecting tattoos is really intimate and fun and exciting. This is exciting too.
I love that. That's awesome. Yeah. And also the fact that, as you mentioned, it's like public, it's like anyone can see this, but you know, these are mine. And it's kind of like your public wallet where anyone can see these, but these are mine. Very cool. All right. So the future of NFT art or digital art or, you know, like, yeah, how is, I guess we can just say, what does the future of art look like with, you know, we have NFTs, we have AI, we have mixed reality, like we're headed into a very weird world. Like what is going on?
Well, what is going on is a great question. People have been asking that question for forever, by the way. It's not a new question, but it's definitely relevant right now. One of my favorite paintings of all time is by Paul Gauguin. And it's this massive painting, a panoramic thing that he made in towards the end of his life. He was actually planning to kill himself after he made the painting. He's a very dramatic person. But it's got a French title, but roughly translated in English, it's where do we come from? Who are we? And where are we going? Might not be in that order, but I think at least for me, when I look at the painting, he doesn't actually answer any of those questions. That's sort of the beauty of the painting, is it's really just the questions themselves. It's not the answer. And I don't think the answer is actually really relevant or even worth trying to pin down, because it's going to be what it's going to be. What it could be, like, we can talk about that ad nauseum. We can get into the weeds on that. We could have a whole another hour and a half where we only talk about that. But what I'm thinking about with AI, and what I think is exciting, is the idea that, you know, entire artists can exist within code now. Like, you can create an autonomous artist, and someone could own that artist. Like, that's crazy. You could own a piece of that artist with a bunch of people. And probably the most obvious example of this is Botto. What's happening with Botto. And I don't know enough to about Botto and how it works to get into it. But I think that idea of an artist that doesn't exist is really, really, really exciting. On-chain art is really exciting. Art with no dependencies is really exciting. Infinite art is really exciting. And I'm sure artists are going to go out and explore all these things in ways that I could never predict or imagine. You know, when I first started to understand what 113 and Zaltgeist had made with Terraforms, with Mathcastle, the Mathcastle studio, I was totally blown away. You know, I never would have thought you could create a sculpture, basically land art, a massive castle, the hypercastle, out of code and have it exist on chain. But they found a way to do that. They put a structure into the blockchain. And that, like, nobody could have predicted this. No, nobody could have predicted somebody would figure out a way to do that. So I think there's going to be similar things that happen. Botto is just one example of a current ongoing project that I think is pushing the boundaries. But AI is an unprecedented discovery. We've kind of like discovered aliens for the second time. But the internet was the first discovery of aliens. It's like David Bowie talks about how discovering the internet was like discovery of aliens. But this is really like that all over again. So I have no idea. I have no idea what life will feel like, look like, beyond just NFTs and art, like what the world is going to feel. True. And look like.
Amazing. All right. Are you ready for the closing questions?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. What are you bearish on?
I'm bearish on aristocratic organization. Basically, any of these sort of established, entrenched order, I think, is threatened right now. And you could even include like the dollar and fiat currency in that aristocracy. But I think we're in a massive shift right now, and I'm way more bullish, if you will, on the kids and the youth and the internet and the infinite, basically. The stuff that's been around forever, I don't think they're going to get much stronger. Like, they're looking pretty weak right now.
That's awesome. All right. What are you bullish on? You can't choose anything that you've mentioned in this pod.
I'm actually recently really bullish on music, not music NFTs, not music NFTs, to be clear. Maybe blockchain will play a meaningful role in music, but music's always really been important to me. I kind of like lost touch with it for a while, but I've been discovering new artists now, thanks to the internet, you know, and the artists that are doing everything by themselves, right? Who would not have been popular and probably won't be like broadly popular anytime soon, but who are making really, really weird, intelligent, niche stuff that, and they're finding their audience via the internet. Clowncore is a band that I'm currently like Clowncore. Really obsessed with. They're so cool. It's so fucking cool. Clowncore is cool. Ecology Homestones are really cool. I'm interested in experimental avant-garde music. That's what I'm bullish on. Very cool.
I love that. Okay. What is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
Ooh, man, this is it for sure. At least professionally. Best piece of advice I've received professionally was when I was working as a administrator in the fine arts department at Sotheby's, my first real job, my first paid gig. One of my bosses, who'd been in the business for decades and had a really thick skin when it came to all this stuff, I was experiencing some minor disaster, and the client was really overreacting, and my other boss was really overreacting, and I was sweating because I'm like, oh fuck, am I gonna get fired? Like I really screwed the pooch on this one. And this old guy is, you know, seen it all, looked at me and was like, in this very laconic, droll, like English accent too, said, "Now in this industry, in the art world, there's no such thing as an emergency." And I was like, oh, that kind of takes the pressure off. And he's right, because like, we're not doing brain surgery. Nobody's on the operating table. There's right. like not at the end of the day, what's at stake is art. And it's like, art, yeah, art's important, but I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, like protect the art, you know, we got to save the art. You got to save humanity. You got to save people's lives. So and this is all just fun and games.
I love that. All right. Last question. What motivates you?
My family. Yeah. My wife and my son. And my dog and my mom and, you know, the people around me. Yeah, that's my motivation. Really, it's just like our life. But you can extend that too. I'm not going to say like my family includes everybody in the world because that's extremely stupid. And right. obviously not true. And just me trying to save face and expand this beyond like my selfish boundaries. But like I care about how I'm going to impact this world and how, my son will impact this world, and want to make sure to empower him to be a kind person in in the face of a really challenging place, a bewildering, scary place. But that's my main focus. It's like I want to be successful in this industry too, of course, right? Like I want to secure a future for us. At this point, now that I have a son, it's like beyond me. It's for right. it's for him.
Noah, thank you. This was incredible. I had an absolute blast. I learned so much from you. If people want to find out more about yourself or Fountain, where should they go?
So if you want to find Fountain, it's FountainXYZ on Twitter. I am Noah0X0 on Twitter. And both of our DMs are open. You can hit us up there. That's really where we exist online.
Incredible. Noah, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Andrew. It's really been a pleasure. I'm so glad that you invited me on and I got to just kind of ramble for an
hour. Of course. No, it was incredible.
Really, really nice way to spend my day, honestly.
Amazing. Thank you.